This week on Vox Talks, can machine learning help us to spot risky borrowers? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. A decade ago, we learned that doing a good job of deciding who can borrow, how much and on which terms, is fundamental for the health of the global economy. But we also discovered that the way we assess who's going to be a risky borrower is far from perfect. So could machine learning improve on the credit industry's current methods? A new paper suggests that there is dramatic potential for improvement. Well, joining me today to talk about this is Stefania Albanese of the University of Pittsburgh. She did this research with co-author Domonkos Vamosi, who is also at Pitt. And Stefania is also a CEPR fellow. Stefania, welcome to Vox Talks.
Hello, Tim. Thank you for having me.
Credit scoring is fundamental to the financial system, isn't it? How pervasive is it today?
In the United States, it's very pervasive. So if you don't have a credit score, it will be very hard for you to access any type of credit. In Europe, the market is a little bit different and it changes from country to country. Rather than having one or two scores that are produced by independent firms, most bank or consumer lenders will have their own internal models by which they score consumers based on the information that they have on them.
And these scores are proprietary. Do we know how they are constructed, where the numbers come from?
Unfortunately, we don't know very much. For the United States, which has a long track record in this, there's actually two pieces of legislation that govern credit scoring and what needs to be revealed about the scores. And these are the Fair Credit Reporting Act of 1970 and the Equal Opportunity in Credit Access Act of 1984. These two pieces of legislation have had some amendments over the years, but the core principles remain. And basically, what credit scoring companies have to reveal is just the four most important factors that affect credit scores. And what they report in their marketing information is that these factors are the length of the credit history, so how long basically a consumer has been using credit, credit utilization, that is how much of their available credit the consumers are actually using, and then the variety of debt products. So having more different types of debt typically improves your score as opposed to just having one type. And also, of course, mispayment history and delinquency behavior also matters for the score. But other than these four factors, we do not know very much about how credit scores are determined.
Do we know in that case how good they have been at predicting which consumers are going to default?
We don't know much about this either. And this is because, as you said, these models are proprietary. And of course, they have, you know, high commercial value to the entities and firms that make them. And it's very hard to find out what the performance is, because one necessary condition is to have the source data that the credit scoring companies use to develop their models and to actually score consumers. And this data is expensive to acquire. Very few people, particularly independent researchers, have it. And so it's very hard to assess the performance. You know, I became aware of the potential lack of performance or inadequate performance of credit scores in actually prior work that I had done on the housing crisis, where with other co-authors, we had noticed that there were a lot of high credit score borrowers defaulting at really, really high rates during the housing crisis. So clearly, the credit scores weren't reflecting their probability of default at the time. And so that's actually why I started digging into this problem and trying to find out more about credit scores and how they were determined and so on. And I encountered a wall in my research. I started doing this work when I was a research officer at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, where they have, you know, a very large data set of consumer credit reports, obviously all anonymized. And so I was using that data. And when I returned to academia, I was able to secure some grant funding to buy my own data set, which is smaller than the one that's available in the Federal Reserve System, but still large enough basically to conduct this research. And so in this paper with Domonkos, we essentially show that if we look at the five categories of risk based on credit scores, which would be deep subprime, subprime, near prime, prime, and super prime borrowers, you know, based on how good the credit score is, About 20 to 25% of all borrowers are misclassified. And the differences in default rates across these categories are very large. These are large mistakes that the credit score makes in terms of billing people in different credit scoring categories.
Is the reason it's making these large mistakes just because it doesn't have enough data? Or is there a more fundamental problem here with how the credit scores are constructed?
The data that credit scoring companies use is data in consumer credit reports. And so that's basically a 7-year history of all consumer credit transactions, except for payday loans, which are exempted from this reporting requirement. And so it's actually very good data. And in fact, you don't need all 7 years to develop a model that can adequately and accurately predict default risk for consumers. Our hypothesis, it's really more of a function of the types of statistical modeling that is used by the credit scoring companies. And so that's actually the angle that we tackle. We use data that is essentially the same data that they have available when they develop these models and build their scores.
Yes, so because you have that same data, you can compare the results that you're getting with the sort of existing results that the credit scores are providing. And therefore, you can know if you're doing better than them.
Absolutely, because we do have available for all the consumers in our data in every quarter, we have their credit scoring. So that's how we can carry out a comparison between the predictions of our model and the credit score. And then also we see the realized default history as well. So we have the realized behavior, the behavior that's predicted by our model, and the credit score.
Okay, so now on to the difficult bit, Stefania. How did you create your model?
In two ways. On the one hand, we use insights from economic theory and as well as my prior research. As I said, I've done quite a bit of work on mortgage defaults during the housing crisis. But also with another co-author, we looked at personal bankruptcy, particularly around this 2005 reform of the personal bankruptcy system in the United States, which we used as a laboratory to understand, you know, what drives personal bankruptcy, but more in general, personal default. So we used some empirical evidence that I had gathered in my own prior work, as well as, you know, economic theory to think about what the determinants and the factors that might be very important for personal default might be. And so we used that to think about which variables, you know, we should use as inputs of our models. And then we thought about, well, what kind of a statistical problem is this? So the credit scores basically target a particular type of default, which is becoming 90 days or more delinquent on any debt in the next 2 years. About 30% of the population at any given time, you know, are in default according to this definition of default. So it's not a small fraction. But default is very persistent. So if you're in default, you have a tendency to stay in default. And if you're not in default, you have a tendency to not become in default. Yeah. So that's a hard statistical problem, because if you have two very persistent states, you know, switching from one state to the other is quite infrequent, even if there are at any given time about 30% of the population that are in one state. Standard econometric models that we usually use in economics are just not that great at predicting to start with. They're more for explaining the data, finding out correlations and so on, but not great at prediction, whereas machine learning is. The other advantage that pointed us to machine learning is that just by examining event studies of default behavior for a large set of consumers, we realized that the interactions between possible explanatory variables for default and the default behavior itself were very highly nonlinear. And there were these high-order interactions between potential explanatory variables as well. You know, machine learning seems very well suited, particularly deep learning, which is a type of machine learning that we use, because it is designed for prediction. So it does really well at prediction. And it is designed to accommodate complex data relationship that we found to be present in our data. It's also great if you have very large data sets. So our data set is large. We have a panel of 1 million consumers that we observe quarterly, and we have about 250 variables on each consumer in each quarter. So it's what could be referred to as big data. And standard econometrics is not great yet for this kind of big data type of problems. So really, deep learning seemed like a natural way to go.
And when these scores come out of your model, how different are they to the existing credit scores that are being provided for these consumers?
The first premise is that we actually produce a predicted probability of default for each consumer. So our number can be interpreted as a probability, so it's very transparent. The credit scores, I think people know, are a proxy variable. They're just an ordinal ranking across consumers. So credit scores mostly vary between 350 and 850. So 850 is a perfect score, you know, would correspond to very low probability of default. 350 is the worst score. And so they do not actually correspond to a probability of default. And in fact, the distribution of credit score is stable over time.
That's very interesting, isn't it? So at a time when a lot of people are in default, there are still the same number of people with a very good credit score.
Basically, because it's just a relative ranking. And, you know, that's by construction. So it's just not something you can get around because, you know, that's how the credit scores are designed, which makes it a little bit hard to compare. So in order to enact the comparison, what we did is this. So because in the industry, what really matters is not really whether your credit score is 685 or 692, but whether you fall in these basically five industry bins, which I mentioned before, you know, deep subprime, subprime, near prime, prime, and super prime. So we looked at how big each of these industry bins are. And then we basically created similar bins, but based on our own predicted probability of default. And then we said, well, okay, so if the credit score says you're a subprime borrower, right? If your credit score falls in the range such that the industry would consider you a subprime borrower, where would our model place you? 25 to 30% of borrowers are either subprime or prime, and the other three groups are smaller. If you're a subprime borrower, according to the credit score, according to our model, 15% of subprime borrowers are in fact deep subprime borrowers. So they have, you know, a higher probability of default. And about 10% are near prime borrowers. And then there are even some borrowers that, according to our model, are prime or super prime. So basically, this is evidence that we have that about 20 to 25, 30% of borrowers are misclassified, meaning they're classified as subprime, but they're actually end up in a different bin, which can be worse or it can also be better. This is basically how we enact the comparison. Our model does really well placing, based on, you know, then the realized probability of default of these borrowers. That's how we assess the performance of our model. We compare our predicted probability of default to what these borrowers actually then do in terms of default behavior. We have a rank correlation that is 99%, and we have a really good performance for all categories of default risk. So we do well with the highly risky borrowers, but we also do very well with the low-risk borrowers. Instead, the credit score has a tendency for low credit score borrowers to attribute to them a score that's lower than it should be based on their exposed realized probability of default. And the opposite is true actually for the high credit score, low risk borrowers. So the performance error, if you want, or discrepancy goes in different directions for different types of borrowers, whether they're high risk borrowers or low risk borrowers.
Because as you said, in your previous research, you found out that during the financial crisis, a lot of very creditworthy borrowers defaulted. Would your model do a better job at catching those potential defaults?
Yes, because our model produces a probability of default and we have a data set that's nationally representative. So if we take the average probability of default in our population, that is actually an estimate of the aggregate or economy-wide probability of consumer default. And our model tracks really well, you know, the behavior of this aggregate. If somebody had our model, they would have been able to predict the rise in defaults that happened during 07 to 09. But also our model could be used for macroprudential policy because after the financial crisis, you know, the regulatory system has introduced macroprudential policy and macroprudential concerns need to be assessed in the evaluation of bank balance sheets and so on. And so with something like our model, you know, it would be possible to determine the aggregate default risk attached to a particular portfolio of loans that an individual bank has, but also like a system-wide probability of default for the entire banking system, because the credit scores do not correspond to an actual probability of default. And by construction, you know, the distribution is always the same. They are just not able to do this. But your question was more specifically about these high credit score borrowers. The hypothesis that we have about that behavior is that in credit scores, conventional credit scoring models having a variety of different types of debt typically boosts your score. And what I found in my other work is these high credit score borrowers who defaulted were borrowers who had multiple mortgages. So we call them real estate investors in this other work.
Yeah.
And so to qualify for your second and third and fourth mortgage, you need to look like you're a really good credit risk. But both during the financial crisis, but also in normal times, you know, these real estate investors have much higher default rates than, you know, conventional mortgage borrowers that will just have a mortgage for the home in which they live in. And these borrowers hardly ever default. So the credit scores attributed to you having multiple mortgages, they interpret that as a positive signal, but that is not consistent with the historical behavior of this class of borrowers. And whereas conventional credit scoring models really emphasize credit utilization as a key driver, so if you're maxing out your credit lines according to credit scoring models, you're highly likely to default. We do not find that that is an issue, but we do find that total debt balances and actually the variety of types of debt products show up as an important factor increasing the probability of default, which should not be interpreted as a causal relation because our model is not causal, but it does point out borrowers with a lot of debt, such as these, you know, real estate investors with high credit score, but that were borrowing high value loans. It seems to be more important than the factors that are stressed by conventional credit scoring models.
One thing that you pointed out right at the beginning is if you don't have a credit score, you are locked out of a lot of the credit market. A lot of people suffer from this. It increases inequality as well, doesn't it? Can your model help people who are locked out of the credit market at the moment?
Yes, we were particularly moved by this concern, following up on some studies that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau did a while back on these so-called unscored consumers. And an even deeper problem, but which is one that we cannot tackle, is this so-called credit invisible. So these people that are completely shut out of the consumer credit sphere because they never get any loans. But the unscorable consumers is something that we can tackle because these are people who are in the consumer credit system. So they do have a credit report, but they do not have a score. And part of the reason that they do not have a score is that actually the most widely used score, which is the FICO score in the United States, has very strict requirements about which consumers can be scored. So they have to have been active in the last 6 months. And so if you have some information in your credit report, but it's essentially older than 6 months, they will not score you. And other credit scoring companies have been working on this as well, try to reduce the number of unscored individuals, exactly because if you are unscored, you don't have access to many different kinds of credit. So we purposely avoided including any lagged variables in as explanatory variables in our model, because what this implies is that if you have a non-empty credit record in a given quarter, we can score you. We can provide a predicted probability of default for you. And so like this, we can score most consumers in our data set. Whereas according to studies that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau did, about 10 to 15% of consumers are unscored in the United States. This has been a concern of the credit scoring industry. And so even FICO has produced a new kind of score where agents can put in additional information. So not just what's in their credit report, but maybe information on their telephone bill, utility bills, and so on, to be able to get a score. But that boosted, as it's called, score, it's not the official FICO score. And, you know, many lenders, when they check your credit record and they're considering you for a loan, they might just get, you know, your regular FICO score. And that might not be available for 10 to 15% of consumers who are active in credit markets.
Now, one of the problems with machine learning, as I understand, is that it's essentially a black box. It can produce a score or a ranking, as your model does, but it can't necessarily explain itself. And I would have thought that would be extremely useful, if not essential, when you're producing a credit score to try and work out where it's come from. Is there anything you can do about this?
Yeah, so this was actually one of the reasons why, you know, we were initially a little bit skeptical, sort of adopting a machine learning approach. And I think it's also one of the reasons why in economics, you know, machine learning is still not widely used, because if you do run a regular regression, then you have these estimated regression coefficients that you can interpret. You know, they're marginal effect. They can easily be related to economic reasoning, economic models, and so on. So I agree that is potentially a limitation. But in the last 2 or 3 years, maybe 5, partly because the use of machine learning has spread out from computer science to more applied fields, economists, engineers, chemists, you know, are interested as why do we get that prediction, not just that the prediction is good. There has been a real interest in the computer science literature in developing techniques that would help, you know, applied users to get to this question that you ask, you know, break the black box and figure out what is going on, you know, underneath all these algorithms. And so there are these new interpretability techniques, as they are called, that essentially give you some information about if the default prediction varies across individuals, which factors matter most for this variation. And so we use some of these techniques in our analysis as well. Those can be obviously very helpful because they tell you what drives the prediction. And again, I have to stress that for our model, because it's not a causal learning model, the interpretation shouldn't be causal. But like in a regression analysis, where not all regressions, you know, have a causal interpretation, but it's still useful to look at the estimated coefficient. So this is basically the way we can use these interpretability calculations. And this is how we get the result that, according to our model, what really matters is what the total amount of debt is for a borrower. So somebody who has more debt is more likely to default, period. And it's not, for example, credit utilization or other factors that are stressed out. So these kind of results are useful because they could potentially drive or inform economic modeling of default, as well as they could be the basis of some causal analysis. And one of the exciting new areas actually of machine learning is causal machine learning, which I think is very appealing, particularly to economists. And so what one could do is use a model like ours, which is not causal, and then use these interpretability techniques, examine which factors turn out to be important, and then think about a causal hypothesis, and maybe then go the next step and use causal machine learning, you know, to do something a little bit more refined. That we are certainly interested in doing that, you know, in future work. Though the purpose of this particular paper is really just getting a good prediction of consumer default and make the point that we can do much better than the credit scores in this dimension.
Can you put a number on how much this could save for lenders? And I suppose if there's a saving for borrowers as well.
Yeah, so any number is going to be very approximate and kind of crude. But we did a calculation for both lenders and for borrowers. And so for borrowers, and this should really be interpreted as a lower bound, the calculation was based on the following premise. If you have a lower credit score, assuming you get credit, you will be charged a higher interest rate.
Yes.
And so basically we said, you know, based on our analysis of these borrowers who were misclassified, they were given a credit score that corresponds to subprime, but they were really prime, and so on. We computed the net average interest rate savings that would accrue from using our model as opposed to the credit score. So if you rank borrowers into different bins based on our model versus a credit score, on average, net, what is the gain? And of course, individually, some consumers may gain because the credit score gave them too high probability of default and we give them lower. But some consumers may also lose because according to our model, they have higher default risk than the credit score gives them. And also then the savings would also depend on how much these consumers actually borrow. But we found that on average, you know, the savings could be up to $1,000 a year on net for consumers. And this is just the interest rate component. Of course, we're not taking into account that if, according to our model, you should be given a higher score because you have a lower probability of default, then you might actually be able to borrow more as well. So we're not taking that into account. We're just looking at the interest rate savings on net that accrue, you know, based on current borrowing behavior. And then for lenders, you know, we thought about this thought experiment. If you know that a borrower is going to default, what you can do to cut your losses is basically reduce their credit line. So they're not going to borrow more and you're going to prevent this overborrowing that might drive them into default. And so if you are going to be predicting default based on our model versus a standard credit scoring model, you should be more accurately able to cut credit lines to potential defaulters, and this would accrue some savings. And the savings would depend on what the maturity of the loan is, as well as what the prevailing interest rate on the loan is. And so in percentage terms of balances on the loans, you know, the savings that we compute for lenders at a 15% interest rate, which is a very common interest rate for consumer loans in the United States, for a three-year loan is around 10 to 15%. But this is just based on this credit line cutting behavior. Of course, there could be other responses that lenders might think about if they have better default predictions. So these numbers, you know, I think they are suggestive that the savings on net and on average for consumers and lenders might be quite substantial. But they are admittedly very crude. And one would need to think about, if I was a lender, I think about different strategies that I have, and I could compute different savings based on my strategies for dealing with defaults. So this cutting of credit lines is just one of the possible responses that lenders, you know, could have in response to higher default risk.
Well, if I am a lender and I'm listening to Vox Talks, I sort of assume they all do. I'm immediately thinking, I could employ this model and I could start saving money tomorrow. It's not very much. Academic research has an immediate commercial application. Yours does. Are you considering that?
So, I'll not say anything about commercial applications. For now, I will not comment on that. We were really motivated more by the policy regulatory angle, as well as by the consumer protection angle to some degree, because as you probably know, in the US, credit scores are used very broadly, not just in the consumer credit sphere. So, if you just even want to open a bank account, which of course doesn't involve any credit, but they'll check your score. To rent an apartment, they'll check your score. When you sign up for a phone contract, they check your score. When you apply for a job, they check your score. So the score is so pervasive. And the fact that we know so little about how it's determined and how it performs can really generate a trap for certain kinds of consumers that might prevent them from being able to open certain types of checking accounts or from being able to qualify for certain kinds of housing or certain kinds of jobs. So that's really our angle. But of course, we do recognize the commercial value of this, as well as the macroprudential application, potentially applying it to loan portfolios to assess risk of banks or even the banking system more in general. And so we definitely realize that, and certainly it's not something that we exclude.
It sounds like they've been in touch with you, have they?
As I said, I'm not going to comment.
Okay, we'll leave it at that. Stefania, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim.
We're probably going to see a lot more academic research using techniques like this in the next few years. So this paper's not only interesting in itself, but it really helps to show us why machine learning is going to be huge for economists and policymakers. So I really recommend you read it on the CEPR website. It's DP13914. It's called Predicting Consumer Default, a Deep Learning Approach. And the authors are Stefania and Domonkos Vamosi, as I mentioned at the beginning. This has been a Vox Talk from the Center for Economic Policy Research. We're here every Friday, so subscribe on your podcast platform. We're on most of them for a new episode every week. And check out the archive at foxeu.org/vox-talks.